were being a tractorist meant. Mere suspicion of espionage was itself a felony, carrying with it a sentence of 8 years. What this meant in practice was explained by one prisoner. Every Soviet citizen is suspected of espionage if he has ever been abroad or ever associated with a foreigner. Naturally, every foreigner is suspect. Association means any correspondence with relatives, friends, acquaintances, or professional colleagues abroad. People who were earlier sent abroad by the state itself for study or training are suspected of espionage because of these very journeys. So are the employees of diplomatic and trade missions abroad. Similarly, any encounter with a foreigner inside the Soviet Union can be dangerous. The manner in which the arrests were made was not exactly conducive to calming down the population. It was always in the middle of the night when a car could be heard stopping on a street in an era where there were very few motorists. Then would come the sound of men walking up the stairs and pounding on a door when everyone in the building was asleep. A search of the location, some evidence seized, and the suspect would be taken away. Russians joked about the relief they felt when someone knocked on their door in the middle of the night to tell them that the house was on fire. Some of the fortunate ones thought ahead to pack a bag and were allowed to bring it with them. Others were lied to about only being brought in for a brief chat. Parents innocently vanished without saying goodbye to their children, expecting to be back momentarily. One of those arrested later described the typical experience. From the moment he's arrested, the prisoner is kept in constant suspense. No matter what is done to him or where he's taken, he is given no explanation. This permanent uncertainty and complete helplessness in the grip of a silent, uncanny power produces in every prisoner exactly what is expected to produce: fear. He begins to fear every change in his condition. Perhaps it may be a change for the better, but he is afraid anyhow. And the NKVD plays with virtuoso skill upon this fear. Even when the prisoner is not called for interrogation, he is never allowed to settle down. The examinations of the accused were often invasive and humiliating. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote, the destructive intent of the first hours of prison is to isolate the new prisoner from his fellows so that there is no one to offer him any encouragement, so that the weight of the whole elaborate apparatus bears down on him alone. Women would be taken into an unheated staircase, stripped naked, and then ordered to lift their hands up. Then every crevice was examined in view of other people. Men were treated no better, being forced to spread their buttocks and demonstrate there was nothing under their genitals. Anything that could be used to harm others or oneself was confiscated. One prisoner recalled how her cellmate's glasses had been taken away, of course, for anyone who had glass might use it to cut open her veins. It's unclear which situation was worse, the cells where the prisoners were packed shoulder to shoulder with the room filling with the hot air of people desperate to breathe, or the cells where the prisoners were kept in complete isolation for months or even years at a time. The methods that the latter type of prisoners used to keep themselves from going insane varied from working out math problems over and over, to reciting all the poetry they'd ever heard, to closing their eyes while walking in small circles and recalling past trips that they had taken. Some were kept in solitary confinement for so long that they lost the ability to speak, the muscles in their mouth having become atrophied due to lack of use. As for the former, their humanity was stripped from them as well, as they were reduced to animals in cages. The whole process of the disintegration of personality took place before the eyes of everyone in the cell. A man could not hide himself here for an instant. Even his bowels had to be moved on the open toilet situated right in the room. He who wanted to weep wept before everyone, and the feeling of shame increased his torment. He who wanted to kill himself in the night beneath the blanket trying to cut the veins in his arm with his teeth would be quickly discovered by one of the cell's insomniacs and prevented from finishing the job. Because any private relationship was a threat to the public order, the authorities took care to make sure the prisoners themselves didn't form bonds in their captivity. Applebaum describes one NKVD order from 1935, which explicitly forbade prisoners to talk, shout, sing, write on the walls of the cell, leave marks or signs anywhere in the prison, stand at the windows of the cell, or attempt to communicate with those in other cells in any way. Worse, the prisoners would themselves be at risk if they noticed something but kept quiet about it. This is not even to mention the many informers throughout the prison system who relished the opportunity to have something to report to the authorities in exchange for bettering their own personal situation. Napping was also forbidden, so that even sleep was denied to the accused as a means of escaping the horrific reality. Strong electric lights throughout the prisons were never turned off. What might seem like a waste of precious electricity made sleeping at night difficult, especially when combined with the cramped sleeping conditions and rules forbidding prisoners from covering their faces or obscuring their hands under the blankets. Yet the interrogators themselves were also under enormous personal duress. If some of you entertain doubts and vacillations, Yezhov told his men, if some of you, for this or that reason, do not feel strong enough to cope with the Trotskyite, Zinovyite bandits, let them say so and we shall release them from the investigation. It was a beautiful piece of totalitarian doublespeak. The only reason someone might feel the need to show mercy to those who are plotting against the people would be some sort of sympathy with them or some sort of squeamishness about the party's process. Both were themselves clear grounds for arrest, and the interrogators, more than anyone else, knew exactly what that would entail. Getting confessions out of the accused thereby became a matter of life and death for the captors themselves. Evolutionary pressures encouraged the most evil and ruthless to succeed, since what was rewarded was not serving justice, but rather getting the prisoners to confess. Not every interrogator was driven by sadism or mindless obedience. Tales abound of those who were frustrated to the highest degree by a prisoner's intransigence. They knew perfectly well that the prisoner was telling the truth about their innocence, but they resented having to work so hard in order to get them to sign their confession. As one communist explained it, the Russian communists are absolutely impregnated, more exactly infected, with this theory of two truths. One, the real truth for the initiates, for a small governing circle. The other, the lie truth for the non-initiates, the great mass of the people. In its ultimate development, this philosophy of two truths has led to the lie, which permeates the whole social life to the point of hypocritical and lying declarations and testimony and the monstrous trials of the penitents. People arrested for absurd reasons had little room for recourse. Conquest described how one Czech citizen is reported as having had to confess that he became a German agent early in the First World War, at a time when neither Czechoslovakia nor the Soviet Union existed. Ostensibly, they could write to the authorities to set the record straight, and many wrote letter after letter to anyone and everyone, including Stalin himself. The ones who were most loyal to the party or to Stalin personally were usually the ones who took the longest to get the picture, and it was often years before they realized that no one would be coming to their aid. The guards understood the situation, with one admitting to his captive that, "We never arrest anyone who is not guilty, and even if you weren't guilty, we can't release you, because then people would say that we were picking up innocent people." Stalin was perfectly aware that many of those arrested were entirely innocent. Far from the fist-pounding dictator from Hollywood films, he loved to have a good drink and tell jokes with his comrades. And just as the average man in the Soviet Union spoke forbidden truth using humor, Stalin too loved to tell a good anecdote. As he himself put it, "One day a boy was arrested by the NKVD and accused of writing Eugene Onegin. That was written by Pushkin," insisted the boy. Well, a few days later, the interrogator ran into his parents on the street. "Congratulations," he said. "What for?" they asked. "Your son confessed to writing Eugene Onegin," he told them. As the show trials and purges continued, one massive unanswered question remained. If there were in fact dozens of Trotsky fascist conspirators operating in the highest levels of the government of the Soviet Union, how is it that the authorities could point to one and only one person killed by all these plotters, namely Kirov? Many thousands of men and women were vanished, if not slaughtered, by the secret police. How could the class enemy, which was supposed to be pernicious, pervasive, and powerful, not claim even one other victim? John Dewey and several other prominent American intellectuals sought to answer that question. Under the leadership of the seminal American progressive, the Dewey Commission investigated the evidence against Trotsky and others in order to come to an objective conclusion about what was going on in the Soviet Union. They were led to some obvious questions after the information provided by Stalin's prosecutors. It is evident, even from this incomplete list of alleged terrorist groups, that the alleged conspiracy ramified widely into Caucasia, Transcaucasia, the Ukraine, Siberia, and involved a large number of people. It is therefore astonishing, assuming that the evidence represents the truth, that it was discovered only after 5 years, according to several accused that began in 1931, and that during those 5 years, in spite of intense activity, it resulted, according to the records themselves, in precisely one assassination, that of Commissar S.M. Kirov on December 1, 1934. The accused include Smirnov, leader of the famous Fifth Army during the Civil War and conqueror of Kolchak, Muralov, a leader of the October Revolution in Moscow and former commander of the Moscow military area, Mrachkovsky, one of the heroes of the Civil War in the Urals and former head of the Urals military district, Drobnyus, a soldier of the Civil War, twice condemned to death by the whites and once shot by them and left for dead. These men had records of courage, resolution, and action in the service of the communist revolution and the Soviet state. It's hardly credible that if they had decided to overthrow the Soviet government through terrorism, they would have gone about it in such dilatory and amateurish ways. Naturally, Stalin thus turned to creating more victims, perhaps the first imaginary victims in Soviet history. Maxim Gorky was one of the greatest and most renowned authors of all time, not just in Soviet Russia, but throughout the world. As such, it was widely known that he had passed away in 1936 at the age of 68. Valerian Kubishev had been a member of the Politburo that governed the USSR and one of Stalin's closest economic advisors. He was only 46 when he died in 1935. Finally, Vyacheslav Menzhinsky had been chairman of the secret police for 8 years before dying in 1934 at the age of 59. All that was left to do was to demonstrate that these three men had actually been murdered and the existence of the anti-Soviet, anti-Stalin conspiracies would be established. Anger over learning that one of Russia's most beloved authors had been killed would surely drive the public into fits of rage against the perpetrators. Having found some victims and invented the crimes, it now simply became a matter of getting confessions. But who was there to blame? As economic calamity could be blamed on wreckers, so could health issues naturally be blamed on the doctors. Yet their doctors needed to confess to crimes that not only hadn't they committed, but to crimes that had never even occurred to begin with. Gorky, Kubashev, and Menzhinsky had all died of natural causes. Yezhov set to work. He realized that he wouldn't need to break all three doctors. All he had to do was to break one and then have him turn on his two colleagues. He thus set his sights on Professor Dmitry Pletnev, who had a reputation as the most outstanding heart specialist in the USSR. One of Yezhov's female NKVD operatives accused Pletnev of having bitten her breast in the course of examining her 3 years prior. It was completely false and utterly absurd, but the newspapers ran with it all the same. After decades of hard work, the doctor's reputation was reduced to the newspaper's new epithet for him, the sadist Pletnev. The respected medical professional was then publicly denounced by former friends and students, not that they had much choice in the matter. Over the years of his career, Pletnev had treated some of the most prominent citizens of the Soviet Union, all of whom now ignored his desperate letters, beseeching them to help clear his name. The second target, Dr. Levin, had treated both Stalin and his daughter, though such connections did him little good. Dr. Kazhakov was the final target of the accusations. One at a time, the men were sat down and told what they had done. Yezhov's predecessor, Yagoda, had summoned each of them individually and demanded they murder their patients. The court heard testimony that the doctor poisoners took Gorky from an overheated room and into freezing cold over and over until he died. The men had supposedly been too afraid to defy Yagoda and either warn their patients or turn him in, despite personally having direct access to the highest officials, including Stalin himself. Pletnev was spared death, but Kazakov and Levin were executed. In any event, Kirov was legally no longer the sole victim of those plotting against Stalin and his men. Chapter 6. Try to imagine what it is like. The NKVD had no shortage of ways to get their victims to confess to crimes. There was no shortage of simple brutality to effect a confession, though a very few resisted. The Polish-born Konstantin Rokossovsky was a brilliant military man and great innovator when it came to the art of modern warfare. He was 40 years old when he was arrested, and Yezhov's men began to work him over for claims of being a spy and a foreign agent. They broke his ribs and smashed his toes with a hammer. The NKVD men pulled out his fingernails and 9 of his teeth as well. When that was not enough, they told him that he was going to be executed, taking him in front of firing squads, but never actually shooting him. But Rokossovsky never broke, and when he was later freed and worked alongside Joseph Man of Steel Stalin against the forces of Hitler, he did so with a smile full of new steel teeth. The physical brutality committed against the accused was invariably loud enough for other prisoners to hear, and this was by design. It was the NKVD's way of letting those in its power know that it would be their turn sooner rather than later. One prisoner recalled the effect such inhuman sounds had on her. "I thought about the fact that the man had gone on calling his torturers comrade when they were already beating him. He could think of no other word for them and called them comrade when they fell upon him like beasts." At a certain point, the accused understood and in his agony cried out to the only loyal name left to him, "Mom, Mom, my head!" She and all the others heard him scream over and over. Sometimes the pressures weren't so brutal in their application. The tale of the pseudonymous Comrade Ivanov was one such example. An old Bolshevik with an impeccable pedigree, he had repeatedly been arrested by the Tsar. After the revolution, he and his equally beyond reproach wife had made the mistake of siding with Trotsky. They were deported to Siberia before being brought back and imprisoned in Moscow in 1936. It took 4 months of trying to break Ivanov, but old Bolsheviks don't break easily. What was 4 months in a Moscow prison to a man who had done 10 years doing hard labor in some godforsaken corner of Russia? Eventually, Yezhov himself attempted to discover what was taking so bloody long. After seeing Ivanov refusing to break, Yezhov simply phoned Ivanov's mother-in-law in the man's presence. "This is the NKVD. Comrade Ivanov wants to know how his children are." "It was the middle of the night," she told him, "and the younger boy was sound asleep." "Do you want me to give her a message?" Yezhov asked Ivanov. "Tell her to take good care of the boy," Ivanov replied. The Bolsheviks did in months what the hated Tsar couldn't do in a decade. They broke Paul Ivanov. He cried when they hung up the phone and signed whatever confessions they put in front of him. Historian Orlando Figgis points out that in 1935, the Soviet government had lowered the age of criminal responsibility to just 12, partly with the aim of threatening those in prison with the arrest of their children if they refused to confess to their crimes. A second decree that year allowed the arrest and imprisonment of relatives of anyone who was imprisoned for crimes against the state. In effect, a hostage system was declared. By that point, the execution of children had been standard, though unofficial, practice for quite some time. It was one of the ways that the Bezporozhne, the orphans of war and famine, had been culled in previous years, but that was done under the cover of darkness. Making teenagers liable for the death penalty caused an enormous backlash in even communist-friendly Western circles. Yet by making it official, certain other actions were now not only possible, but in a sense, unremarkable. It was Yezhov's policy for his interrogators to have a copy of the decree on their desks. We are also told, recounted Conquest, that fear of reprisals was made more dramatic and emotionally effective by the display on the interrogator's desk of private belongings of members of the family. It's amazing what human beings will do when their families are threatened and when they're aware of how little they can do to save them. Eventually, every inquisitor of the NKVD was obliged to have on his desk during the interrogation of the arrested Bolsheviks the law which decreed the application of the death penalty to children. But even this wasn't the worst of what was done to get confessions out of various men and women. Stanislav Kosior had been instrumental in implementing Stalin's assault on the Ukrainian peasantry. One of the surviving photos of Kosior has him seated in a row directly below Stalin. Stalin has his hand atop Kosior's bald head, and the two men both have big goofy smiles on their faces. It was a bit out of character for Bolsheviks, who were meant to look tough and ruthless. As General Secretary of the Ukrainian SSR Communist Party, it was Kosior who issued several decrees imposing the confiscation of grain, as well as deporting thousands of families. He was also complicit in covering up the causes of the mass famine, using the Ukrainians themselves as scapegoats for the millions that died. In December 1933, Kosior addressed the All-Union Central Executive Committee of the Soviets. There, he offered up an alternative history wherein Stalin was saving the Ukrainians instead of decimating them. Throughout the two-year period, much as we tried to revive the agricultural economy, we failed to do it. You, comrades, all know that considerable aid in the form of food and seeds was given not only to Ukraine, but also to other districts and regions of the Soviet Union. This must be credited to the exceptional persistence on the part of Comrade Stalin, who succeeded in accumulating, even under such circumstances, certain reserves that were afterwards used to aid a number of provinces. These reserves helped considerably to plug the gaps that were a result of our errors in many localities. Stalin's purge made its way through the Soviet power structure to silence virtually anyone who knew too much about his atrocities. Kosior had insisted that the causes of the Holodomor lay not in objective conditions, but mainly in the low quality of our local work, the caliber of our local leadership. But Kosior knew perfectly well what had caused the famine, and that forbidden knowledge was itself largely enough to sign his, literal, death warrant. In January 1938, Stalin recalled Kosior to Moscow and made him Deputy Prime Minister of the USSR. He was arrested 4 months later. There are few of us who know what it means to experience torture. The closest analog is an action movie. The hero is tied to a chair with his hair carefully tousled and his lips slit open. Though exhausted, he's defiant against his captors. His refusal to back down is both a source of frustration to his foes and a testament to his strength. It is a powerful image, but also a Hollywood fabrication. Historian William O'Neill pointed out that tortures weren't simply used by Stalin's men to get a confession, but also to effect the complete disintegration of his individual personality. As O'Neill explained, a man woken up in the middle of the night, unable to satisfy his most elementary physical needs during the hearing, sitting for hours at a time on a small, hard stool, blinded by the light of a powerful bulb directed straight at his eyes, surprised by sudden, cunning questions, and by an overwhelming crescendo of fictitious accusations, sadistically taunted with the sight of cigarettes and hot coffee on the other side of the table, and all this going on for months, sometimes even years. Under these circumstances, he is ready to sign anything. That, however, is not the essential point. A prisoner is considered to have been sufficiently prepared for the final achievement of the signature only when his personality has been thoroughly dismantled into its component parts. Gaps appear in the logical association of ideas, thoughts, and emotions, become loosened in their original positions, and rattle against each other like the parts of a broken down machine. The driving belts connecting the past with the present slip off their wheels and fall sloppily to the bottom of the mind. All the weights and levers of mind and willpower become jammed and refuse to function. The indicators of the pressure gauges jump, as if possessed, from zero to maximum and back again. The machine still runs on larger revolutions, but it does not work as it did. All that had a moment before appeared absurd now becomes probable, even though still not true. Emotions lose their color, willpower its capacity. The prisoner is now willing to admit that he had betrayed the interests of the proletariat by writing to his relatives abroad that his slackness at work was sabotage of socialist industry. It is unclear what torture methods were attempted on Kosior to get a confession. The most frequently used was known as the conveyor, where the prisoner is not allowed to sleep and is questioned endlessly. Every 4 hours, his interrogator would be replaced by a new fresh man, just like a conveyor belt, and so the questioning would resume again as he stood against the wall without sleep for over a week if necessary. The NKVD investigators tortured prisoners for many hours at a stretch and repeatedly, recounted Medvedev, brutalized interrogators disfigured prisoners. They not only beat them and kept them from sleep, food, and water, they gouged out eyes and perforated eardrums, pulled out fingernails and toenails, broke arms and legs, burned their victims with red-hot irons, and mutilated sex organs. Others were beaten until their eyes popped out of their heads, a level of violence so inhuman as to seem like something out of a cartoon. Prisoners who were beaten to death were legally registered as having had heart attacks. In some cases, the murder was more extreme, such as when the head of the cross-examined prisoner is tightly bound with cord into which a small stick, a nail, or a pencil is inserted. By rotating this inserted stick, the cord wound around the skull tightens to such an extent that finally the skull is scalped, the skin with the